asserted against it in some 200 pending asbestos cases. The plaintiff sued for exposure caused by Burlington Northern's unbroken, uninterrupted, and continuing negligent transportation of asbestos-containing ore from a loading dock in Libby, Montana. To use the plaintiff's words, as reflected in their oral argument exhibit, they sued based on, quote, BNSF's consistent and constant industrial activities. That's at page 786 of BNSF's oral argument exhibits, which underscores the point that is important for the first issue, which is the existence of a single accident or occurrence. The trial court erroneously held that plaintiff's alleged exposure, each plaintiff's exposure, is a separate accident or occurrence. This holding is wrong because the claims arise from a single accident or occurrence, and based on that determination, Zurich exhausted its policy limits when it paid $4.5 million pursuant to a settlement in 2012, and in so doing, it exhausted its continuing duty to defend in the cases that have come forward. I'm going to focus, there's a multitude of issues that are covered in the briefing. I'm going to use the time today to focus on three of them. First, the standards for determining whether there is a single accident or occurrence and the accompanying exhaustion analysis. Second, Zurich's equitable defenses and considerations, which also should inform this court's analysis. And third, a separate issue which pertains to an exclusion for completed operations. Before we start drilling down into those, I'd like to set the table here a little bit because it's important to bear in mind Zurich is not asking this court to hold or to go anywhere that BNSF has not already gone. BNSF took the position in litigation filed in 2002 in Tarrant County that these very same types of claims out of Libby, Montana, were a single accident and occurrence. It did that in that context because it was suing its commercial general liability insurers, and BNSF wanted there to be one occurrence so it didn't have to pay multiple deductibles.
Is there any philosophical difference between the approach that we should take towards CGL policies as opposed to OLT policies?
With respect to occurrences, it's the same analysis. Occurrences are occurrences. The standard is the same. The standard focuses on the cause test. And I think when the court drills down, what the court will see is when the trial court declares that each plaintiff's alleged exposure in the Libby lawsuits constitutes a separate accident or occurrence, it's using the wrong test. It's using the effects test. And the standard under Evanston, which we've cited in the brief and numerous other cases, is the cause test. What is the cause of the alleged harm, not what are the effects of the alleged harm? Stated another way, the accident or the occurrence is not the injury. And so
with regard to coverage, counsel, we're not dealing with an eight corners situation where are we bound in any way by the plaintiff's pleadings of it as independent individual injuries, as opposed to a continuous? We don't get to make that continuous determination with regard to the duty to defend as opposed to pay. The duty to defend, that comes in based upon the showing that y'all have already exhausted your limits, don't we?
So a couple of answers to your question, Justice Birdwell. Number one, we're under the eight corners plus rule, most recently discussed by the Texas Supreme Court in BITCO. And the particular context of this appeal arises in connection with a duty to defend. But that does not mean that multiple occurrences can be manufactured simply by pleadings that say the plaintiffs were exposed in diverse locations at diverse times and in diverse ways. That is so because the cause test governs here. And I'll give you a specific example of a situation where exactly those types of distinctions that BNSF.
But you see what I'm saying is that you're arguing that you're arguing that each of these individual lawsuits that have been brought and individually pled that invoke the exposure from this one particular area, you're effectively arguing there should be aggregated into one occurrence, but you can't get that solely from their individual pleading.
Yeah, the answer is yes, because we're under eight corners plus, and so the undisputed evidence of the payment, of the $4.5 million payment, that's perfectly fair game for the court to take into consideration, because it's not foreclosed by the plaintiff's pleadings, and it's additional information that establishes the coverage determination that in turn drives the duty to defend analysis. And so let me give you, I'm talking abstractly, let me give you a very particular instance of why BNSF's efforts to say this has to be multiple occurrences because there's lots of plaintiffs and they were exposed in diverse ways.
Before you do that, let me ask you this, just for clarity's sake. You're not disputing that the plaintiffs in these respective lawsuits have alleged multiple specific instances, all sorts of different types of occurrences and modalities of injury. You're not disputing that. Judge Birdwell's question.
I dispute that there are multiple occurrences. I am not disputing that the complaints say what they say, and they say that individual plaintiffs were exposed in diverse places and diverse mechanisms of exposure and so on and so forth. But the fundamental point is those allegations still fall under the ambit of a single occurrence, and I would direct the court to, for example, the Atchison versus Stonewall case. It's in the oral argument handout. It was discussed extensively in our briefing, and that's a case brought by the railroads arising from a very analogous situation. 3,800 claims by railroad workers contending that they had noise-induced hearing loss because of the noisy nature of the work. There were diverse plaintiffs. There were conductors. There were trainmen. There were yard workers. There were track workers. There were engineers. They were exposed over multiple years. They were exposed in multiple different environments, on the trains, on the tracks, in the yard, in the shop. And even with all those purported differences, it was still a single occurrence. And it was a single occurrence under the cause test because the cause came back to the railroad's failure to have and manage a hearing conservation program. And so the point is, the analysis doesn't end with saying, well, there were multiple different allegations. That's the beginning of the analysis. The analysis then proceeds under the cause test, not the effects test, but the cause test, and that's what brings us to a single occurrence. And let me give you another example and a piece of language that I think is particularly useful here. So again, this is one of the cases that's highlighted in the oral argument handout that Zurich prepared. This is the Uniroyal versus Home Insurance case, which involved the question of how many occurrences there were arising from Uniroyal's repeated delivery over a prolonged period of time of Agent Orange, the defoliant used in Vietnam. And there were, as the court will recall, many, many hundreds of thousands of claims of service members who were exposed to Agent Orange.
I have a certain REM song running in my head now, so thank you for that earworm.
I appreciate that. Bottom line, that was a very similar circumstance involving shipment of a substance that was alleged to have caused widespread injury, suing Uniroyal for that shipment, and it was a single occurrence, even though the shipments occurred over an expanded period of time and they encompassed thousands of claimants. But here's the particular language that I would direct the court to. So I'm looking at the Uniroyal case, 707 FSUP at page 1384, and this is cited in the handout. The court observed, the finding of a single continuous occurrence is apt for mass deliveries of hazardous products imposing damage on a large number of people. That's the concept that I think you will see running throughout the case law, and it runs throughout the cases we've identified. You've got this Uniroyal case. Uniroyal relies in large part on a Texas Court of Appeals case in Faust, which was the crop dusting case. Similar concept, multiple applications of a hazardous substance, it was still one occurrence.
Do any of the cases in your handout deal with, so I understand that there's a real distinction between the 1965 policy and the two later policies, where the earlier one dealt with an accident, and then later on you get the occurrence definition and the concept of the continuing
exposure.
I can't remember the exact language, but you know what I'm talking about.
No, I do, the continuous and repeated clause. So the answer to your question is yes. The Atchison case covers multiple different policies. The Atchison case was like 40 years worth of policies, basically 1945 to the 80s. And so if you parse through all the findings in that Atchison case, you'll see that there was a particular finding that says for pre-1974, some of the policies had continuous or repeated language or language similar to that, but it only says some of them. It doesn't say all of them. So some of the policies at issue do have the continuous and repeated language, and we believe that certainly reinforces our position when it says all bodily injury and property damage arising out of continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general conditions shall be considered as arising out of one occurrence. We think that's unambiguous, and certainly for the 68 to 71 and the 71 to 74 policies is an answer right there. But you were focusing on the difference between the 65 and the 68 policy, and there are some language differences there. The 65 policy references an accident. It doesn't have a subsequent definition of occurrence like the latter two policies does, but it still gets you to the same place. If you ground this in the Texas notion of what an accident is, and then trace it through the case law, the accident is the negligent act that causes an unexpected or unintended consequence. And I think if you parse through all of the cases, what you will see is that when the cause of that consequence is the same character throughout as it is here, that's what gets you to a single occurrence. And it gets you to a single occurrence under all three policies.
Well, does it make a difference that the two later policies specifically say that you look at the injury and the unexpected nature of it from the standpoint of the insured? I mean, I seem to recall that there were some cases that talk about accident differently, that an accident is something unexpected by the person who's harmed.
You may be referring to the McCallum case, which was the 1949 Fifth Circuit case. I think that the tide of case law has washed over McCallum. The operative standard comes from Evanston, also a Fifth Circuit case from 2018, that captures Texas law and explains that it really is the cause standard, looking at what is the cause. And maybe it's helpful here to sort of explore, you know, what would be the circumstances when there is not a continuous cause. If there had been a prolonged deliveries, but then one of the ore veins ran out and mining stopped for a substantial period of time, then you might have a closer question about whether there had been some sort of interrupting or intervening situation that potentially could create multiple occurrences. Or let's say perhaps a regulatory change or an court injunction or something that stops operations. None of that is present here. The evidence here is uninterrupted, continuing activities by Burlington Northern doing the exact same thing throughout. And again, to highlight the language that the underlying complaints used, BNSF's consistent and constant industrial activities.
Well, and I can't give you the direct quote from BNSF's brief, but essentially their position is that, and I think they make the allegation that y'all have just kind of been myopic in just addressing the deliveries, but there's other allegations and assertions that don't even pertain to deliveries that are a part of those complaints that they would say create their own occurrences altogether. How would you respond to that?
Well, there's a couple of different responses to that. Number one, the insurance premise, these are premises policies, and so the duty to defend has to be assessed against the backdrop of the particular kind of policy. This is not general commercial liability. This is not insuring policies that cover negligent acts by alleged negligent acts by the railroad, no matter where they occur. They're tied to a specific premises. The specific premises is the loading dock 4 miles outside of Libby. And if you trace through the policy language is tied to this location. And so it's not a situation where you can say that because something, you know, a rail car originated in Libby, that is somehow license for insurance across the country. I mean, let me get to your question in a slightly different way by highlighting, I see my time is up. May I complete my answer?
Sure. Yes.
I'll make it brief. Here is BNSF's position. Their position is that if a rail car originated at the loading dock 4 miles outside of Liberty, then of Libby, then wherever that car went, there is an extension of premises coverage. And so that goes to the kinds of allegations that you're addressing. They say it goes to the rail yard, which is 4 miles away in downtown Libby. If you go to the deposition testimony, specifically at page 1868, of the record, what you'll see is BNSF takes the position that there's coverage wherever the tracks go, 1,000 miles away, 1,300 miles away.
Yeah, I noticed that was the position they took at the hearing in front of Judge Burgess.
Which is an extreme position that divorces this case from the premises-based insurance that we're here to address.
Thank
and with
you.
That, I'll wrap up.
Thank you
answer.
Very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sanders?
May it please the court. I'll pick up where Mr. Boyce left off with Justice Walker's question. And the answer really is it's a premises policy, but that doesn't mean that it ends at the premises. And the reason I can say that is there's language in the policy that says it covers the use, ownership, and operations of the premises, river loading facility, and all operations necessary or incidental thereto. And that's a phrase that Zurich has not addressed and has not reconciled. And it makes a particular difference in this case. Because there's a case from the Texas Supreme Court, we've cited in our brief, Lloyd's Casualty Insurance versus McCrary, looks at this exact language and says, that means if your operations continue beyond the confines of the insured premises, it can still be an operation.
So what would be a completed operation in this context?
I think the answer is it depends on what the plaintiffs have alleged, and it depends on what the circumstances are. And the problem we have in the duty to defend context is there would have to be an allegation that essentially pled it out. So perhaps it is BNSF's train left, got to its destination, stopped, and unloaded. This is outside of the asbestos context, but let's just take a hypothetical example. Something happened, and a train car that was sitting there inert fell over on somebody and crushed them. It's just sitting there, not doing anything. The operation's complete. Maybe that pleads it out of coverage. The problem is here, in a duty to defend context, where they haven't had that specificity, if it's potentially covered at all, there's a duty to defend. And that's exactly the way the plaintiffs have alleged it here. And to your point, Justice Walker, they've not only alleged that things happened while BNSF was moving its cars, they've alleged that BNSF owns this particular piece of property. As an owner, it undertook duties to control the dust, to oversee W.R. Grace, that it was acting in concert with W.R. Grace, who's actually bringing this vermiculite onto its property, didn't control its dust. It alleges directly that people were exposed from BNSF property based solely on the fact that they owned it and operated there and didn't clean up the dust. So you don't even have to get to train cars moving before you've already got allegations within the eight corners that people were exposed to asbestos simply by the fact that BNSF undertook duties as a property owner and didn't comply with them.
But So the loading facility is 4 miles away from town.
Correct.
But there are a lot of plaintiffs that are townspeople, right? So how did they get, how specifically did their injuries, I mean, if it wasn't the rail cars going into the main rail yard, I guess there were some allegations that there were mill workers that tracked it back to their homes unwittingly. Is that part of it?
You know, I think factually speaking, we don't really have the answer, and that's an indemnity question ultimately. But in terms of how they've alleged it, they said that they were a whole lot of different things in the community. They were minor mill workers, independent contractors, loggers, homeowners, gardeners, recreators, ball field players, and a whole other list of things that just said they were distinctly exposed to asbestos in unique exposure events and in a wide variety of temporally separated, geographically distinct, and highly differentiated routes and circumstances. They lived in Libby. They've alleged throughout these petitions, and we've laid it out in our brief, and it's also in tab two of your handout, this chart, which I'll explain in a second, that they were exposed in a variety of ways, including directly next to and on BNSF's property. That is a claim that is potentially covered under these policies for the duty to defend. Therefore, it's within the eight corners and has to be covered.
Has there been allegations that the property was generating the dust and that the dust would literally be carried all the way to town?
I don't know that it was that specific. Certainly there's allegations that the property itself was generating dust. I don't know that they completed all the way and say it was carried into town. Instead, they say things like, there was dust on your property, you failed to control it. I was exposed as by virtue of your property, near your property, as a result of your operations. I mean, there's literally hundreds, and I do want to address this real quick. When we talk about the eight corners, I've given you in the oral argument handout all eight corners. And the first tab is a stipulation of the policy provisions of the three policies. The second tab is Exhibit D1 to our summary judgment motion, and what we did here is we took the three types of complaints. There's New McGarvey, there's Old McGarvey, and there's Lewis, and they're essentially all similar, but we took each complaint, put them onto a CD, and then took, and at the beginning of each one of these sets of complaints, the allegations that appear in every single one of them. So Judge Burgess had this, and this really is the eight corners that you need for this analysis. So that's why I gave it to you, because I think that that's important. But our point here is that it's not just transportation. And by the way, that doesn't actually make sense the way that they've put it here, both in terms of what they've alleged, but in terms of the insurance policy itself. So we have three different policies, and as Justice Kerr pointed out earlier, one uses the term accident, one uses the term occurrence, and occurrence is defined.
Do all three use the word exposure, or just the second two?
I believe the second two, because I think exposure is in the definition of occurrence. I can double check on accident.
Because the first one uses the word hazard and then defines hazard, but I don't recall whether hazard includes exposure.
I can't recall standing here, but I know the other two use exposure in the definition of occurrence, and I just don't remember right now if the first policy does.
Okay. What I guess what's troubling me with regard to all of this is that these are policies that are made back in time.
Sure.
The tort laws completely different than what we're dealing with right now. And in fact, the policies that we're dealing with weren't actually to the benefit of BNSF, but they were entered into by W.R. Grace. And so aren't we supposed to be interpreting the coverage based upon the intent of W.R. Grace with regard to what was actually supposed to be covered vis-a-vis Maryland Casualty?
Well, remember,
as opposed to try and impose what we think now, you know.
Well, I think there's a couple of answers. The first one is you're supposed to interpret it based on what's in the four corners of the insurance policy.
Understood, but we're still dealing with this issue of whether or not exposure was actually intended to be covered under the circumstances to some degree, which is why I asked my question about whether hazard included exposure. And to the extent that we're going to be looking at the equity issues with regard to one deductible, if there's only one occurrence, the fact that there's a policy premium for what, $250 with regard to the coverage on the first policy, kind of, is that something we can take a look at in terms of what's intended by the parties to the policy to be covered?
No, because ultimately the policy is not ambiguous, so Texas law doesn't give you the opportunity to go behind that. But if you look at the words on the page, you get to the intention here. And by the way, Grace was not the insured here. Grace paid for the policy, but BNSF was the insured. So I don't know that you would ever get into what Grace's intent was. It's what Zurich's intention was in the words that he
used. Well, the lease agreement required W.R. Grace to do what it did.
Correct.
It was the contracting party with regard to Maryland Casualty. It wasn't BNSF and its predecessor weren't paying the premium. W.R. Grace was paying the premium.
That's true.
Okay.
But
so if you're looking at the intent of the parties to the agreement, you're actually not looking at what BNSF's intent was, except to the extent that you want to go look at the lease agreement.
Well, the intent comes from the four corners of the policy, and they haven't pleaded ambiguity, but if we're going to look at ambiguity, then it gets resolved in BNSF's favor as the insured under Texas law. So that would be my answer to that, is you don't go behind that. But if we're going to talk about the equities, then you also have to consider the fact that in all three of these policies, three times over 9 years, Zurich had the opportunity to protect itself by putting an aggregate limit in the policy saying no matter how many occurrences, no matter how many accident or people, we're only going to pay X. Three different times they didn't do that.
And they didn't put a wasting provision in it either.
True. So you have to take it as it was, and you have to take it as it is today. And while they may wish that they had done things differently, there's nothing on the page that gives them a reason to get an out there. And they talked about eight corners plus. To be fair, they never used the plus in the trial court. And if we're going to talk about exhaustion, and I can turn to that right now, exhaustion is an issue that they have to prove as a matter of law here, and the settlement agreement that they point to just simply doesn't get them there. What that settlement says, by the way, you can look to the front and the back from BNSF's perspective, is it says that the insurers collectively are going to pay an amount, and we're going to divide that up between us. BNSF was not a party to the agreement where they actually divided it up. So at the time BNSF signed the settlement, they didn't know how much they paid. But that's not really the important part.
I know with regard to that briefing, they talk about some type of notice that was given, and honestly, I wasn't clear as to whether the notice was given that we're going to consider this payment of $4.5 million or however much it was to be done with, because we're going to interpret it the same way you guys did when you argued it against the other insurers to be a single occurrence. That wasn't incorporated into the settlement, was it? It was just some type of notice.
It wasn't. The settlement just says, here's what we're going to settle. And it actually leaves open the possibility that there will be future claims against BNSF coming out of these same things and potentially on these policies. It never says we're not going to pay any more of these, never says it's over. It's very careful in the way that it draws the releases. And by the way, what it settled is not just our claims under these policies. There are also claims made under policies that Zurich or MCC, Maryland Continental, gave to Grace. There were claims, both contractual claims and extra contractual claims, and the settlement agreement says we're settling all of that, and we're not letting this settlement serve to determine any coverage position.
But BNSF didn't eventually sign off on the settlement with notice that in doing so they were accepting this concept that this is our last and final payment, we're not going to pay for anything else.
No.
Okay.
We didn't. That's not what it says. So I don't think even factually as a matter of law you can read the settlement agreement and determine, well, this amount of money that they paid, which it doesn't say in the settlement agreement, by the way, went specifically to exhaust these policies. What it says is we're settling all these different types of claims, policies for two different entities, contractual, extra contractual, and by the way, there may be future claims.
Yeah, and my recollection from something I saw, I think, in the hearing was that there was a suggestion that the parties were actually pretty careful to stay away from, I mean, nobody wanted to have very specific cabined release language
right
in that settlement, as I recall.
I think that's right, and that's why the provision is in there, I believe, that says you can't use this for any coverage position going forward, because it was still not a settled issue as to what was or wasn't covered. So when we're getting into exhaustion, I just want to point that out, that even if you assume that it's a single occurrence, they haven't proved it as a matter of law. But to take it back on the single occurrence thing, during the entire discussion you had with Mr. Boyce, I don't believe I heard him actually cite a Texas case. They wanted to talk about Uniroyal, which is a case out of New York, federal district court case. Uniroyal is a class action. And in Uniroyal, the court made that point that this is a class action, and it is the delivery of these hazardous materials that is the act that caused the injury. And the reason for that, by the way, is that's when the manufacturer's involvement was done. They delivered it to a facility, where it went, how it was used, who got a hold of it from there, they had nothing to do with. So from the perspective of causation as to the supplier of that, that was the cause. And they held, you know, looking at that in context, it was a single occurrence because it was essentially these deliveries. That's different than what we have here. The allegations here are BNSF's variety of alleged acts and omissions in different places, times, circumstances directly caused my exposure. That's the allegation here. And in that case, it's a different analysis. Pinkoff's, for example, we cited the Maurice Pinkoff's case in our briefing from the Fifth Circuit. That's a case where they got a load of contaminated seed, and then they actually took bird seed, sold it to different distributors. The distributors passed it along to people who own birds. The birds were sick, they died. They sued the distributors sued Pinkoff's. And the Fifth Circuit looked at that and said, look, the fact that Pinkoff's had a load of contaminated seed sitting there, in and of itself doesn't mean anything. The only time that it actually caused the damage is when it sold each time to these distributors who then put it out to the end users. That's the cause in that case. And that, each one of those, is a separate occurrence. The Buffalo Marine case, where you're talking about contaminated barges, Buffalo Marine had some barges that became contaminated. Later, they loaded those up with fuel, delivered them to a customer. Court in that case looked at it, said the same thing. It's not the fact that they had contaminated barges just sitting there. That doesn't do anything. It's when they actually loaded it with someone else's fuel, contaminated that, and delivered it to the end user. That's the occurrences. The FINA case, which I think is really apt. FINA involved exposure by industrial workers at FINA facilities. They had the whole single occurrence discussion there, exposure to asbestos, by the way. And their Judge Boyle of the Northern District said, look, the exposures are the injuries and the occurrences here. They're claiming I was exposed directly by FINA. And there are multiple occurrences here. I don't have to decide how many, but there's at least three because there's three facilities where these workers were working in. And so we know each one of those is a separate occurrence. There may be more. I don't have to decide that for the duty to defend issue here. So that's the type of case we're talking about here. And just
that was also three separate places. This is one separate place. This is one separate functioning operation doing the exact same thing over an extended period of time. Isn't this essentially kind of a reverse joint and several liability type of thing, where because you cannot exactly determine what the cause was and when and divide it up between the individuals who are making claims, we're going to treat it as one occurrence, just like when you can't divide up the tortious conduct that causes the injury as to what exactly damage was caused, we're going to come up with the concept of joint and several liability and make everybody who contributed to it liable. It's essentially a policy argument in favor of a single cause, a single occurrence.
No, I don't think that's the situation because that's not how it's been alleged. And it's not one place. It's I was disposed distinctly in different locations, different times, and different circumstances. That's what we're stuck with for the duty to defend. You have the eight corners. Now, maybe in the indemnity context, you have to put a plaintiff to their burden. Can you prove you were exposed here? Can you prove you were exposed at this time? That's a different analysis. That's one that's severed and not before the court. We look only to what they pleaded. And what they pleaded here was unique and individual exposures. And let me
ask you a question before you go there. So if these acts and omissions that go outside of the scope of deliveries, if we just set those aside and forget about those, would it be your position for coverage purposes? I'm not talking about an indemnity. For coverage purposes, that every time a train left that yard, that would be a separate occurrence?
No.
If someone was exposed to something from the train.
That's the part that matters.
Yeah.
The fact that the trains are running up and down the tracks by itself isn't an occurrence or an accident. And I think that's another reason that when you look to the policy language, their characterization doesn't make sense. Under any definition of accident, it's something that's unintended, unexpected, fortuitous. No matter whose perspective you use, to your point, Justice Kerr, whether it's BNSF's or the plaintiff's, same thing for occurrence. It has to be something that's like an accident, unexpected. No one's surprised BNSF was running trains. That's why they were there. That's why the river loading facility itself existed. There is no accident in the movement of trains. There's no accident in the fact that they brought stuff down from the mountain and loaded it in the cars. The accident, the occurrence, is when BNSF did some alleged act or omission that caused vermiculite asbestos fibers to come off and encounter the plaintiffs, and they got exposed. That's the accident. That's the occurrence. And that's why you can't have some big overarching banner of 75 years of transportation. Let's take it out of the railroad context for just a second, and let me give you another example and see how this makes sense. Let's assume instead of a mine and a railroad, we've got a gravel quarry. And there's one trucking company that trucks the gravel out every single day. And each truck gets loaded up with a load of gravel, they take it out. One of them is on its way pulling out of this gravel quarry, rock falls off, crushes somebody's foot who just happens to be standing at the entrance. 2 days later, same driver, same truck, different load of gravel, starts to pull out, rock falls off, cracks somebody's windshield who's driving by. No one is going to say, oh, this is one big occurrence because you drove gravel trucks out of a quarry every single day. No, the accident looks to what was the specific thing that you did wrong that caused injury to this person. And here it is a whole bunch of different things at different times and places. Whatever BNSF was doing or didn't do or allegedly didn't do, whether it was an owner of the property, whether it was an operator, whether it was having to do with the loading of cars, whether it was in concert with Grace, whether it frankly was just the failure to warn, which is something else that they allege, what came from those acts that led to your exposure that you're now suing BNSF for? You're not suing BNSF simply because trains ran back and forth. It's only because as a result of some operation in some context, depending on how it's alleged here, it came in. And I see I've got a little bit of time. Completed operations, there's a whole lot of textual things. We've dealt with that in the brief.
Well, let's drop the deal. Two issues.
Sure.
Somebody is putting that vermiculite on the conveyor belt, okay? Yep. So they've exposed themselves to vermiculite before they ever go near the premises that's actually insured. But then they put vermiculite on the conveyor belt, and because it's incident to that particular use of that premises, they may have actually gotten exposed, but there's no way to make a distinction between whether it was the exposure leading up to the conveyor belt or it was the conveyor belt itself that caused it. Plus, you could have a fiber of asbestos that's been on that conveyor belt for 70 years. And it just happens to drop off at the end of that 70 years, and that's what caused the injury. So, again, why wouldn't that be a single cause? Because that would be 70 years of operation, and it just happened at that point in time to cause the injury.
Before you answer, would you add 2 minutes to Mr. Sanders' clock, please?
Well, I think the answer to your question is, and for purposes of indemnity and proving the actual causation for indemnity, that kind of thing matters. Because it really is the plaintiff has to prove the facts that get the coverage for indemnity. For the duty to defend, we only have to look at what they alleged. And nobody here has alleged I was exposed to an asbestos fiber that was sitting on this belt for 70 years. Okay. What they've said is,
BNSF. I tried to come out with the most outrageous thing I could possibly do. So okay. That's what I do.
But. Okay, well, I hope that helped. Just briefly, in my kind of remaining time, I do want to touch on completed operations because I know we didn't get to that. Completed operations is a potential exclusion here, but under all three policies, what it requires is, number one, a completed operation, and number two, away from the premises. If they want to use the exclusion as the insurer, then they have to show you as a matter of law, whatever lawsuit it is has pled itself into that exclusion. They haven't attempted that. If you look at Exhibit D1, there's a couple hundred cases in there. Haven't pointed you to a single one that contains allegations only about completed operations. And I think, Justice Kerr, it was your question earlier about when do they complete. It depends. It depends on the day, the time, the train, what the question was, and for the duty to defend purposes, we don't have to answer it. Did they allege things that potentially fall within operations that are not completed and away from premises? Yes, they did. And that's the end of it, absent them showing you, here is a petition that says, this single operation that was already done exposed me. So with that, Judge Burgess had what he needed. He followed Texas law. He looked at the four corners of the insurance agreements. He looked at the four corners of the petitions and concluded that there were allegations that were possibly covered here. That's all that they had to do for the duty to defend. Zurich hasn't met its burden on anything else. This court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Boyce, out of fairness, I'll add another 2 minutes to your time if you would like it. You don't have to use it, but if you want 7 minutes, you can take 7 minutes.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. We'll see how fast I talk.
Okay.
A lot of the hypotheticals, I think, are effectively answered by this statement. The policy language indicates that one occurrence can cause many accidents or a series of accidents, and that any single accident may result in multiple personal injury claims. That's BNSF's statement from the Stonewall complaint. It appears in our Appendix 4 of our brief. I think that captures the notion here of the way that BNSF now is impermissibly trying to granulate or slice and dice everything into multiple occurrences. It goes on. The vermiculite claims have alleged a single cause of their asbestos-related bodily injury, sickness, and or disease, which constitutes a single occurrence. And so I think that's why this effort to draw out these fine distinctions doesn't get the railroad where they're trying to go. I heard a challenge to say, well, you're citing a bunch of out-of-state cases. How about some Texas law? Okay. I will direct the court to the Faust case, which is included in our handout. That is the crop dusting case. And Faust bases its analysis very strongly on the Uniroyal case. The Uniroyal case can't be cabined as, oh, that's class action. That doesn't make any difference for purposes of counting occurrences. I think what you see is this progression, that if there is an allegation of a systematic exposure, like there was in Faust, or an allegation of a systematic exposure over a longer period of time, like there was in Uniroyal, or an allegation of a systematic exposure of time to multiple plaintiffs in multiple diverse locations and contexts, like there was in Atchison, it's a continuum that all takes you back to the same result, which is single accident or occurrence. There was some discussion, and Justice Kerr, you had asked about some of the language, exclusion language, and I think essentially asking BNSF to say, are you really saying that this coverage goes across the country and wherever the tracks are? The answer is, yeah, that's really what they're saying, and the policy language doesn't permit them. I would direct you to the 1965 policy. Let's take a for instance. Appears at page 576. The exclusions under paragraph C, 2, and 3. That covers the notion that the operations are complete when loading is complete, and there is a specific exclusion for it does not cover the hazards or the risks on or from premises other than as defined, which are owned by, rented to, or controlled by the named insured, i.e. BNSF. So everything comes back and is focused on the loading dock. That was the insured premises. That is undisputed. That was the insured premises that, as Justice Birdwell pointed out, Grace bought the insurance to cover BNSF. And we can understand why it would do that and why it would buy a premises policy. If the worker falls off the ladder on the loading dock, you know, fixing something, that's the type of coverage that I think is reflected by this policy. It's not a nationwide, rolling, never-ending basis for saying that if a railroad car originates there, it can go anywhere and the coverage will follow it.
Let me ask you this, and it's, I guess, legally probably neither here nor there, but I'm just curious. So did BNSF also have some sort of CGL or premises coverage for its main rail yard in Libby? And if a car comes from the loading dock, loading facility, and goes to the main rail yard, does another set of insurance potentially pick up from there?
The direct answer to your question is I will have to double check the record to see if it reflects other CGL coverage there. But I think what the case law does show is that, you know, BNSF is a sprawling, sophisticated operation that has all kinds of insurance across many years. That's what the whole Atchison case was about. That was nationwide policies for CGL. And so I think it would be reasonable to expect that, but I can't give you a pinpoint record site. With the time left, I do want to address this aggregate limit argument that was also put forth, which is the contention is if there's not some dollar amount stated as an aggregate limit, that somehow there can't be limits. And the answer to that is it's limited by the number of occurrences. I'll give you a specific site, page 580, under limits of liability. If you look at coverage A, coverage B, you'll see that it's limited by the number of occurrences, and that's why we have the fight that we're having. With that, I thank the court for its time, and we renew our request for the court to reverse the trial court's summary judgment and to render judgment in favor of Zurich.
Thank you very much. Your case is submitted, gentlemen, and the oral argument has been very helpful. Appreciate your time this afternoon, and we'll take a quick break before we start our next case. Thank you.